This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
What millennials prefer in a president? I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Today's young adults are now the largest generation in the U.S. That could mean a lot of sway in the November election. So what does this group want to hear from the next occupant of the White House?
On the health front, with more people administering care to elderly relatives at home, what are the best ways to teach them this enormous responsibility?
In sports, what would the Summer Olympics in Rio look like without the full Russian track team?
And the class action lawsuit by former professional wrestlers over concussion injuries.
This lawsuit, it's part of an ongoing feud, really, in a series of litigation against the WWE. And really what the lawsuit is contending is the following. Head injuries cause long-term brain damage, right? And that even though they were aware of these risks, they hid the risks away from the wrestlers.
Waleed Tamari, an attorney in Chicago, breaks down the case. He joins us later in the hour. The national political conventions being held by Republicans and Democrats this month represent what could be the last opportunity to engage millennials in the political process before their idealism fully fades and their faith in the system craters. That's the feeling of John Della Volpe, director of polling at Harvard University's Institute of Politics. He explored the question, what do today's young adults want from the next president? John, what do we have?
We found some common ground, right? 5 points. The first two might be obvious, okay? Grow the economy. This is just an incredible amount of economic stress that we have throughout America, but in particular with young people, trying to find enough money to attend college, trying to pay for college, and try to make a life after college. Yeah. So that's clearly number one. Number two, reducing the terrorism, threat of terrorism at home, as well as abroad. Two very, very kind of tangible things. Number three, number four, less tangible, but I think equally as important. Millennials, Democrats, Republicans, independents, they really want to see America united in a way that we can address inequality on every front. Demographic, sociographic, education, economics, gender, et cetera. They want to address inequality. The fourth part of this agenda is they want someone who can inspire that kind of post 9/11 sense of unification that we had when we were all Americans, when Democrats as well as Republicans hung our flag.
Yeah.
They want to unite America. And the fifth and final point is they think we can get there if we can begin to reduce the significant role that big money has in our politics today.
Interesting. All right. So on that note, then, did you find that they were engaged? Do they want to be involved? Because I think sometimes we feel that they're not.
Well, it depends upon your definition of involved, right? So they're incredibly involved in making the country a better place every day. In fact, in many years, you have more young people roll up their sleeves and volunteer in the communities than actually vote. So they involved. I don't buy for a second kind of the pessimism or the narcissism. It's the question is, are they involved in politics and government? And that's a question. You know, we took a step back in the 2012 campaign where less than half of people under 30 voted. It's going to be a question whether we can bump that over 50%. But again, I think it's less about caring and involvement and more about kind of the state of our politics today. Mm. Essentially, you know, less than one in four trust federal government, trust Congress, trust the media, trust Wall Street to do the right thing. And if they don't trust the systems and the instruments of power or the people who represent them in terms of the major candidates for office, they're less likely to vote.
Mm. We're speaking with John Della Volpe. He's director of polling at Harvard's Institute of Politics. And we're talking about the question, what do millennials want from the next president? Do the millennials, John, differ from, say, other generations, whether it's X or the baby boomers?
I think in the two big issues, they don't, in terms of kind of economics and terror. I do think you'll find that the sense of kind of inequality is something that young people, millennials, are a little bit more sensitive to than other generations. One of the most interesting findings we've had in some time is from our spring survey, which is still very relevant, where we asked whether or not millennials supported a variety of different things, including capitalism. We found that a majority of millennials did not support capitalism, or at least the way in which it's practiced in America today.
Really?
They are kind of less supportive of capitalism than any other generation. However, even people, you know, you have to get over the age of 50 before you have a net level of support of capitalism. So differ a little bit from Gen X, and certainly much more with kind of boomers in the silent generation.
How about that? This is a little beyond this, I guess, but I'll ask anyway. Are there proposed solutions from the millennial group?
Well, I think you'd have to ask Bernie Sanders for that. Bernie clearly had very specific, I think, kind of solutions to deal with some of these issues that we raised, certainly around kind of economics and inequality. And I think, though, both either at this convention or next week's convention in Philadelphia, I think if the parties and the candidates actually began working more closely with millennials, they could potentially create additional solutions that work just not only for them, but for all of America. Young people want to engage. They want to play a greater role in this campaign than just voting. And I think that's one of the messages that's been consistent from our work over the last decade or so.
All right, so you bring up an interesting point then by introducing Bernie Sanders to the conversation, and that would lead me to ask, since the millennials are the largest generation ever, could we see a socialist elected as president in 4, 8, 12 years?
I did say that they weren't supportive necessarily of capitalism. It doesn't mean that they're supportive of socialism. And actually, the numbers around socialism were actually far lower than capitalism.
Okay.
When I talk to young people and I follow up with that question in a conversation, they tell me they want what they'll call kind of a compassionate capitalism. They talk to me about maybe a combination of Roosevelt, you know, somebody like Teddy who could break up banks, you know, and hold them accountable, but somebody like Franklin who could provide like a stronger infrastructure or safety net. So I think the combination of those things is what a large number of millennials would support.
Thanks, John. John Della Volpe, Director of Polling at Harvard's Institute of Politics. 13 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, the Leslie Jones controversy on Twitter. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us for weeks. The cast of the new all-female Ghostbusters reboot has fired back at sexist critics and misogynist trolls who don't like them. But as the movie's only black star, comedian Leslie Jones has been subjected to an especially vile level of abuse. This past week, she decided she wanted everyone to understand just how bad it had become. So she started retweeting the hateful messages and videos. It's a story from Caitlin Gibson at The Washington Post. Caitlin, this was bad.
When you go through her feed and look at the messages she was getting, it's really pretty stunning.
Man, can you tell, or is she able to tell, like, were most of these people using real names or hiding behind some anonymity?
Almost never. I mean, are they using real names? I mean, and if you look at a lot of the users, you can often go back to their profiles and see that they have, you know, vague or obvious links to white supremacist groups.
Oh, brother.
Many of their Twitter avatars are just, you know, they're not real images of real people.
I think,
so they're definitely hiding behind multiple levels of anonymity here.
You know, I think that's it's conversation for a different day, but you see it too. It's just, I think that's the most disappointing or frustrating thing, that nobody wants to put a name to it, so they act like cowards.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, oh boy. And so did Twitter do anything?
So they did. So the CEO, Jack Dorsey, actually followed her and tweeted at her. A lot of people took note of this and said, you know, please message me privately. And then, you know, they released a statement late Monday night, I believe, or very early Tuesday morning, saying that they had suspended some of the accounts that were associated. And then now, of course, everyone is talking about the fact that Twitter has permanently banned a man named Milo Yiannopoulos, who is a conservative writer who has often been behind some of these more coordinated troll attacks.
Yeah. All right. So, and what's his deal? What's his background?
Well, so he has sort of fashioned himself as, you know, a leader of what a lot of people call the, quote, alt-right, which is one of my colleagues, Abby Olheiser, described it as a nebulous online grouping of meme lords, gamer gates, and anti-PC conservative activists.
Wow. Okay.
So, you know, he often rallies them into targeting opponents who can be anyone from, you know, liberals, establishment Republicans, feminists, people of color, with trolling campaigns, and those often quickly escalate into particularly vile abuse, as we saw on Monday.
Jeez. We're speaking with Caitlin Gibson, staff writer at The Washington Post. Her piece is called Why Leslie Jones Wanted the World to See the Hateful Tweets She Receives. So she did get some report, some support, right? As you reported, there were some other celebrities who weighed in sort of expressing support for her, love for her, and stuff
absolutely.
Like that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there were, you know, there was a hashtag that started, Love for Leslie J, her castmates, and then just hundreds of fans and many celebrities, you know, Elizabeth Banks, Margaret Cho, William Shatner. A lot of people were weighing in and offering her praise and support and also joining in her calls to Twitter that they take some action against her abusers.
Yeah. All right. So the case with these abusers, though, is that especially the anonymous ones, they get taken down but resurface under another name probably, right? Or fake name.
Yeah,
Twitter
that
handle.
Often happens. You know, I mean, and even with Milo Yiannopoulos, he's been suspended multiple times and has come back. They say this time the ban is permanent. But he's a very high-profile troll, if you will. You know, a lot of these smaller accounts, I think, are much trickier for Twitter to track and deal with. I mean, they can, you know, kick one off, but if you open up another account under a different name, the problem can kind of come back that way.
Yeah. Thanks, Caitlin. Caitlin Gibson from The Washington Post. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Looking for the next place to grow or expand your business? Why not look to a state that's a top 10 pro-business state, where 2,000 unnecessary regulations were eliminated over the past 5 years and is now home to the sixth best entrepreneurial climate? All this and more awaits you in the state of Michigan, the state that should be the number one choice for your business. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
Hey, glad you're with us. Maybe you've seen this in your family. I've definitely seen it in mine. As hospitals send patients home after shorter stays, and many patients live with multiple chronic diseases, more families are taking on complicated medical tasks. That includes giving injections, changing surgical dressings, and operating special medical equipment, often, though, with little instruction. Who's supervising here? Here's Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landreau. Laura, what do we have?
Well, I think most people don't realize the extent of this, but they say as many as 43.5 million Americans are caring for a ill or disabled or elderly relative at home. Obviously, this is all unpaid care, and it's, you know, billions of dollars in unpaid care. But what people are increasingly having to do is not just do simple things for them, but do real, you know, medical tasks, things that traditionally were only done in the hospital, like give injections and hang IVs and dress wounds, all the things that you're used to just nurses and doctors and you know, nursing assistants doing.
That comes with a certain risk, I presume.
Well, it does. I mean, you know, the problem, there was a survey, a very interesting survey done by AARP and the United Hospital Fund that found that the majority of these folks who are out there doing these tasks for their family members never felt that they got sufficient training and were really uncomfortable in their ability to do it correctly. You know, they were afraid they would hurt them or that there would, it could be an infection. So there's just a lot of concern around how well are family members really prepared and trained to do this sort of thing.
Wow. All right. So what's the best way then to teach this stuff?
Well, right now, there's enough recognition about this that there are 31 states, including New Jersey and Oklahoma, have enacted this law known as the CARE law that basically requires hospitals, when someone's being discharged, to sort of notify a designated caregiver and provide them some help, give them the opportunity to ask questions about medical and nursing tasks, figure out what they might need assistance with or instruction in. And then, you know, look, everybody, there's a lot of things you can learn yourself right now. Everybody's like, you can go to college online. So there are more and more resources being created and put online, AARP and the Family Caregiver Alliance. There are a group of organizations called the Home Alone Alliance, which is kind of a funny twist on the movie Home Alone, but it's literally about people who are home alone taking care of other people. And they are creating videos, how-to instruction kits, just all kinds of caregiver training materials, video tutorials, things that you could use at home, like, okay, how do I give an injection, or what's the best way to dress this wound? How exactly do I do this IV? So those are a lot of the things that are being created so people have help.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landreau. Her piece is called Smarter Ways to Teach Family Members Medical Skills. Is there liability here?
Well, look, obviously there's a chance that you're going to make a mistake, just as there's a chance you're going to make a mistake in the hospital. There are liability issues only in the sense that you might hurt somebody or that you might do something wrong. But basically what I was told, and what, you know, one of the, Heather Young is the dean of the Betty Irene Moore School of Nursing at University of California, Davis. They are helping to create these video tutorials with AARP. And, you know, basically she says, look, you know, families provide the bulk of care to the aging population in the home, and the nursing aspects of care, like managing medications and wound care, they're difficult and they may be intimidating, but it's well within their abilities with the right tools and training.
In some ways, is this care that an elderly person might not have gotten at all?
What has been happening is that they've been getting it in sort of a patchwork, piecemeal basis. Okay. And the survey that they conducted, I think it was in 2012, was the first sort of really stark look at how, you know, all these families performing these complex care tasks at home with little or no training. So, you know, again, half of family caregivers were performing these tasks. And a lot of them, by the way, are with, you know, Alzheimer's care is a big part of this. A lot of people are caring for Alzheimer's patients at home.
Yeah.
And 3 out of the 4 family caregivers who performed those tasks were managing medications, including IVs and injections.
Thanks, Laura. Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landreau. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Need a website? Why not do it yourself with Wix.com? No matter what business you're in, Wix.com has something for you. Used by more than 84 million people worldwide, Wix.com makes it easy to get your website live today. You need to get the word out about your business. It all starts with a stunning website. With hundreds of designer-made, customizable templates to choose from and the drag-and-drop editor, there is no coding needed. You don't need to be a programmer or designer to create something beautiful. You can do it yourself with Wix.com. Wix.com empowers business owners to create their own professional websites every day. When you're running your own business, you're bound to be busy. Too busy. Too busy worrying about your budget. Too busy scheduling appointments. Too busy to build a website for your business. And because you're too busy, it has to be easy. And that's where Wix.com comes in. With Wix.com, it's easy and free. Go to Wix.com to create your own website today. The result is stunning. Hey, thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, the class action lawsuit by former pro wrestlers. We'll have analysis. Country music star Sarah Evans is here, and the former leading tech device that's at the end of the road. Find out which one in about 20 minutes. Well, what would the Summer Olympics look like without the Russian track team? The Court of Arbitration for Sport has rejected the claims and appeal of the Russian Olympic Committee and 68 athletes who had challenged a ban from the track federation that would keep the country from competing in Rio next month. More from This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Russian track and field athletes are one step closer to being banned from the Summer Olympics in Rio. Following this developing story, Rachel Axon of USA Today Sports. Rachel, how did we get to this point? What are these athletes accused of doing?
So a report commissioned by the World Anti-Doping Agency was released in November that found widespread state-sponsored doping in Russian athletics. After that was issued, the International Association of Athletics Federations, which is the international governing body for the sport, provisionally banned Russia from competing internationally. They set in place a bunch of criteria for the the Russian Federation to meet to, you know, basically come back in good standing with the IAAF. And the task force that was measuring all of that found in June that not enough of those criteria had been met, that a doping culture still remained in the country. And so the IAAF voted to extend its ban of the Russian Athletic Federation, which effectively is keeping the Russians from sending a team to Rio. In doing so, they created an exception. They changed one of their rules regarding eligibility to say that they would have a process to review individual cases and any athlete who could demonstrate that he or she had been subject to effective anti-doping systems by living elsewhere, by living in another country, had not been tainted by the Russian system, could be granted an exceptional eligibility to compete in the Olympics as a neutral athlete. And so that was what was challenged before the courts.
The Court of Arbitration for Sport made a decision Thursday. What happens next?
Where track is concerned, that's kind of it. The IAAF has received several applications for that exceptional eligibility. So far, only two have been granted, with one of them being to the whistleblower who provided much of the information here. The larger question now is what kind of precedent or what framework this sets for the IOC to consider a larger ban of Russia entirely from Rio.
Do individual Russian athletes have any more recourse?
I think they probably could take this to Swiss court if they wanted to, but typically that's not a successful route. So unless they get their application for eligibility approved by the Doping Review Board at the IAAF, this might be the final chapter for them.
What about the athletes that are not track and field athletes but are Russian? Will this trickle down to them as well?
Well, it's very likely that this will influence the IOC's decision. WADA commissioned a second report following up on further investigations of Russian doping back in May that was released on Monday. And what that showed, it was led by Canadian lawyer Richard McLaren, who was on the first commission that reviewed this. And that report showed a wider spread doping culture that we didn't know existed. It confirmed that the Sochi Games, the lab with the assistance of the FSB, which is kind of like their version of our FBI, it's their federal security service, and the Ministry of Sport and the Center for Sports Preparation for the National Teams of Russia all were involved in a process by which they covered up positive tests. And during the Sochi Olympics, that meant going in and swapping out urine samples during any other time during this four-year period. It meant just covering up positive tests. And that affected several hundred, more than 600 tests that we know about. That's kind of the minimum. And literally across 29 Olympic sports. So since that was released, there have been more calls for a ban, including by some leading anti-doping agencies. And that's where this CAF decision could come into play as the IOC considers that.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with USA Today reporter Rachel Axon. It's 20 minutes before the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. Another legal firestorm over concussions. This time, dozens of pro wrestlers, including Jimmy Superfly Snuka, are suing the WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment, in a class action lawsuit. They claim the athletes incurred long-term neurological injuries in the course of working for the company. They also allege that WWE routinely failed to care for them. Legal analysis now from Waleed Tamari, founder of the Tamari Law Group in Chicago. Waleed, give us the basics.
So this is what this lawsuit is about. This lawsuit that was just filed actually a few days ago, it's part of an ongoing feud, really, in a series of litigation against the WWE. And really what the lawsuit is contending is the following. It's saying, look, the WWE was aware that head injuries cause long-term brain damage, right? And that even though they were aware of these risks, they hid the risks away from the wrestlers. And that's what the nature of this ongoing litigation.
Wow. All right, so let me ask you this. Is there really any mystery, I guess, about the risks?
You know, it's a very, it's an interesting question in terms of where this case, you know, and to answer that question, you know, some of the previous, you might want to address some of the previous litigation. So in March of this year, there was a court in Connecticut. That's where all these litigations are taking place. The court in Connecticut dismissed a previous lawsuit, large portions, I should say, of that previous lawsuit, because there's a doctrine, I should say, called the contact sports doctrine, and it says, I think what you're suggesting, that says, look, if injuries occur as a result of a contact sport, really the risk should be assumed. And so large portions of the previous cases, and these were different wrestlers, but it was the same type of causes of action, same type of allegations, and the court dismissed based on that doctrine. Gordon, what this case is saying, what this new case that was saying, is, look, you can't use you can't even analyze the contact sports doctrine, because there's a difference between an injury that takes place in hockey, because it's different than a situation where you've got a natural collision that takes place, for example, if you have two hockey players going after a puck. Here, it's different because, in large part, the collisions take place because it's the WWE that orchestrates these types of collisions, whether it's a wrestler throwing a chair at another wrestler or so on. So it's a different standard. That's the plaintiff's allegations.
Right. And to be fair, too, they also claim that medical information was hid from them, right?
That is the claim, and you know, the WWE, you know, they've maintained their position. Their position is that they never concealed any medical information.
When the movie Concussion came out, I remember a stat from that still jumps out at me. Mike Webster taking an estimated 77,000 blows to the head, I think it was, over the course of his career. Not all serious, perhaps, but 77,000 blows nonetheless. And I can remember having interviewed a couple of WWE wrestlers about how they practice their falls, maybe for that reason, obviously, protection, things like that. Where can this lawsuit go? What could happen here?
You know, it's interesting because I think the previous dismissal of the previous lawsuit is actually the plaintiffs are appealing. So the wrestlers are appealing that. And where this lawsuit could end up, I think in large part, is going to depend on what happens with that appeal. So, for example, if this case can go on and the contact sports doctrine is not applied, this is going to be probably a pretty hard-fought litigation.
Thanks, Waleed. Waleed Tamari, founder of the Tamari Law Group in Chicago. 13 minutes before the hour on This Weekend. In today's digital world, there are so many things we can do. We can shop online. We can use public Wi-Fi. We can even bank online. That is, we can do a lot of things that can expose our personal information to identity thieves. But LifeLock believes that you can still feel good about doing these things, because LifeLock can help protect you from identity theft. Unlike free credit monitoring services, which only detect changes in your credit, LifeLock's proprietary technology detects and alerts you to a huge variety of identity threats. And their specialists based in the U.S. work to resolve issues if your identity is ever stolen. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. But with LifeLock, you can do a lot more with more peace of mind. Membership starts at $9.99 a month, plus applicable taxes. Enrollment takes minutes, and protection starts immediately. Call 800-916-7170 or visit LifeLock.com and use promo code Gordon for 10% off your membership. That's LifeLock.com, promo code Gordon. Let's turn to the entertainment front for a few minutes. Do you like country music? How'd you like a chance to go to the CMA Awards this November? Country music artist Sarah Evans is teaming up with Astellas Pharma, maker of the drug Mirbetric, as it is, for what's called the My Big Break sweepstakes. You can enter the sweepstakes at cmabigbreak.com from now until mid-October. Sarah's with us now. Sarah, how'd you ever start singing?
I mean, I started singing in bars when I was 5, 6 years old. I mean, I literally grew up working and being a working musician. My parents were both, you know, very much into music, and they both could sing, but neither of them did it professionally. And I have two older brothers, and so they put a band together with my brothers and me, and we were, you know, performing at rodeos and fairs and nightclubs and, you know, you name it. So I've literally been on stage and making money as a singer since I was 5 or 6.
Wow. Who told you what? who told you at one point that you were no good? Did you ever get one of those? Like, hey, listen, Sarah, you're adorable and lovely, but you should find a different career.
No, I've never been told that. You know, not as far as singing goes. It's just one of those things that it was like, you know, I mean, I've joked a lot that that's my only talent.
What else do you want to do? Let me ask you this. Is there room for your life to do something else that you'd like to pursue?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, I'm starting a new album in the fall, and so we're already, you know, have that process underway. We're writing songs and looking for songs, and I'm working with a new record label that I'm going to announce here pretty soon who that label is. But there's so much that I still want to do. And, you know, I want to continue making music and touring and television. I mean, who knows? I'm open to it all.
But it's got to be music related, in other words. Would you want to act or something like that? You know, we see those transitions once in a while.
Yeah. I would love to act. You know, I was on the television show Nashville last year, and that was really, really fun. I mean, I had a really small part, and I played myself, which was really weird.
Yeah.
But sure, I would, you know, and it wouldn't have to be music related.
Country Music's Sarah Evans. Again, the sweepstakes are CMABigBreak.com for a chance to go to the CMAs this November. By the way, speaking of other things she could do, she could be a supermodel, that's for sure. She hits the road about 2 weeks from now, does Sarah Evans. Opens up in Renfro Valley, Kentucky. 6 minutes in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. The time is near for those of you still in love with the old VHS recorder. If you've got a stash of old VHS tapes, get them transferred to DVDs or perhaps the cloud, because the world's last manufacturer of them is ending production at the end of July. I think what's almost as newsworthy is that a company still makes the VCR, the video cassette recorder. Not surprisingly, Funai Electronics in Japan cited declining sales and difficulty finding parts as why it's ending production of the once revolutionary machines. USA Today says, back in the day, Funai sold up to 15 million VCRs a year, but last year that number was down to 750,000 units. I know you're asking, that many people still bought them? They were first introduced in Japan in 1976, arrived in the U.S. the following year, part of what many consider a revolution in home entertainment. So, little trivia question, what does the VHS in VHS tapes actually stand for? Video Home System. Farewell, by the way, to the VCR. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.